This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Bauer, the chief engineer at Archer Aviation. That company is developing an all-electric eVTOL aircraft for the urban air mobility industry. In the news, bad behavior can get your frequent flyer account deleted. More 737 MAX woes. The Airbus A380 is fading for many airlines. Avalo Airlines starts operation. The Aviation Safety Reporting System is extended to drone operators. And the story of missing luggage. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 653 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, Max. Great to see you here again this evening.
Yeah, glad to have you, as always. Also joining us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hey, Max. Looking forward to talking about one of our favorite topics on that other show, but looking forward to a conversation tonight about it.
That's right. This could be kind of a crossover conversation. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Bauer. He's the chief engineer at Archer Aviation. Now, Archer is a California-based startup in the emerging urban air mobility industry. Companies developing an all-electric eVTOL aircraft with a mission to advance the benefits of sustainable air mobility. You can find them at archer.com. Now, as for Jeff, he has nearly 10 years of industry experience working on eVTOL aircraft. He started his career working on flight control system development and aerodynamic modeling at Z.Aero. But from 2016 to 2019, he was the chief engineer for Project Vahana at A-Cubed. That's an Airbus innovation center in Silicon Valley. He led the engineering team that designed, built, and completed a successful flight test campaign of the Vahana Alpha demonstrator. Jeff, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. And Max and Dave, nice to be here.
That Vahana demonstrator, it was an 8-propeller VTOL, as I recall, urban air mobility solution for short-range transportation.
Yeah, correct. It had it was a tandem tilt-wing configuration, so canard forewing with four rotors on it, and then an aft wing with four rotors on it as well.
And the full-scale demonstrator flew, I believe that was starting in 2018?
Yep, through the end of 2019. I think we flew around 150 flights of that vehicle.
Yeah, uncrewed, right?
Yes, all unmanned.
Right. All right. So that's maybe a forerunner of things to come. Being associated with Airbus, as I recall, the intent of that program was to sort of demonstrate the feasibility of the concept in general.
Yeah, that's correct. We're really looking at the kind of the business case around urban air mobility and the technical feasibility to understand if there would be a follow-on project for a future entry into the market.
All right. Well, we're going to dive in just a second. But first, I have to ask you a question because you're not a pilot, but you have flown a human-powered airplane. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So back in maybe around 2015, I was introduced to a project that originally started as an after-hours project at Google led by someone called Alec Proudfoot, and the project was called Dash for the dead simple human-powered aircraft. So I got involved with that, helped a little bit with the construction flight test, and had the opportunity to fly it a number of times. So good way to marry the energy-efficient flight, cycling, which I do in my spare time, and yeah, do something that's pretty unique. Not a whole lot of people have flown human-powered airplanes. Now, you don't go very far or high, but it was still really fun.
Yeah, not very many people can say that they've done that. That's very cool. All right. Well, just before we get started, in the interests of full transparency, I have to mention that Archer Aviation is a defendant in an active legal claim by Wisk Aero concerning alleged misappropriation of trade secrets and patent infringement. So for obvious reasons, we're not going to be talking about any of that at all in this conversation. All right. Well, with that, let's just jump right in. Jeff, we see so many companies getting into the urban air mobility space these days. How do you think of UAM? What does it mean to you? How do you define it? And why is there so much interest now?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest today, especially just from how far technology has come, especially in the electric vehicle space, you know, with Tesla's success. There's really this convergence of technologies, right? Batteries have gotten more energy and power dense. Electric motors are more power dense. And then flight control systems, computers, sensors, all of that is becoming more commoditized. So there's this really interesting inflection point where you can bring all these technologies together to execute what should be really useful missions for people getting around in urban areas. The technology is not there yet to replace your flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles. But, you know, if you want to fly from San Francisco to San Jose or in these really, you know, Manhattan to JFK, these really congested areas that may take a long time on the ground, but that you can do very quickly and efficiently in the air, there's a really interesting business case that shows up. And I think that's what's driving everybody's interest, along with the imagination of these. Everybody wants a flying car. I don't really like calling them that because they probably won't be personally owned or operate from your driveway, but they really do unlock this new form of urban mobility.
Well, actually, you brought up a point that I've been thinking about lately, which is the applications here that we're talking about. What you hear mostly is passenger transport, generally local, but there is some conversations about a, sort of a regional version of that. There's also cargo or moving packages, delivering items, cargo as opposed to people. But the part that I've been wondering about is, will this, do you think, ever get to the point where these could be personally owned? So maybe Max Trescott, for example, instead of flying around in someone's Vision jet, might be able to fly around in a device like this, in an aircraft like this. Do you think it'll replace GA?
I think it might down the road. But our real focus now is on these other business uses. So it's really, you know, they make the most sense when you can get really high utilization through, you know, like you mentioned, cargo transport, passenger transport. And there's some other niche and really important things that need to consider as well, like emergency services, potentially some military applications for resupply, very similar to the other cargo missions. So those are our focuses today, thinking about those sorts of missions. With if you look at the total market size, it's that passenger transport that dwarfs all the others.
Hmm. There's a report that came out in April of this year, 2021, from IDTechX, looking at the manned electric aircraft projections over the next 20 years. And they see it as a $30 billion market. Now, that's not just eVTOL. In fact, they estimate that of that total electric aircraft market, eVTOLs would account for 48% of them. Conventional takeoff and landing, electric, maybe 32%. In the smaller range, less than 20 passengers, and they are projecting 20% of that market would be going to the conventional takeoff and landing aircraft electric in the 20 to 100 passenger range. So, I mean, it's really difficult to polish this crystal ball that's made out of cloudy glass and
for sure
see what the future.
You see other projections by Morgan Stanley and others that show this being over a $1 trillion industry over the next 30 years. So I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, most likely.
Now, we see a lot of different designs. Of course, there's a lot of different applications. We see, for example, Ehang and some others that are on maybe the smaller end of the scale, looking at maybe a couple of passengers that look more like large quadcopters, four rotors on arms, sometimes with shields and sometimes not, which is kind of a frightening prospect to me. And then there's the kind of design that Archer is developing, that you're developing, which is more of a fixed wing with multiple electric motors, usually along the wing, but not necessarily exclusively. Can you tell us anything about the kind of the different design approaches that we're seeing?
Yeah, so there's obviously a few different types out there. Pretty much all of them will fall into three camps. There's either the pure multi-rotor configurations. Then there's kind of the next level up of complexity where you add a wing and you have some fixed lifting rotors and some fixed forward propulsion rotors. And then the level after that is similar to what we're doing and many other competitors, where you either tilt a wing or tilt some rotors. So there's a lot of trade-offs inherent in all of these designs. At a high level, I like to think about the main challenge of designing these electric VTOL vehicles as, so first off, you have limited energy on board in the batteries. So you need to be extremely efficient in your cruise flight. You don't want to spend a whole lot of time in hover, but the hover is really important to minimize that infrastructure footprint of the vehicles. So you do need a reasonable efficiency in hover, and that is tied very tightly to the disk loading of the vehicle. So given the size of the vehicle or payload you want to carry, you need a certain amount of rotor area to be able to lift that efficiently. Then you need to get into a cruise flight regime on the wing to be efficient. And then you either need to put that disk area you're using for hover into use for forward propulsion by tilting it, or by putting it into a low drag configuration by stowing the rotors or hiding the rotors away. So if you compare these different configurations of vehicles, when you're looking at the pure multicopters, they really suffer in that cruise aerodynamics phase. Mm. So there's some published data out there from NASA looking at DJI multi-rotors or some of their concept. NASA has some bigger manned concept vehicles too. If you look at the equivalent lift to drag ratio, which is very similar to the L over D you guys are pretty much familiar with, but you can use it to also evaluate helicopters or other vehicles. They tend to be in the 1 to 2 range, so not very efficient at all. You're burning a lot of energy and you're not going very fast either. When you start to get to these winged vehicles, that's when you get these equivalent lift to drag for ratios in that 8 to 12, or some people are even claiming a little bit higher than that range. And that's the performance you really need to start seeing higher cruise speeds to save people more time and ranges that are useful. Those are kind of the design trades we think about when we're sizing the rotors and sizing the wings for these vehicles.
Well, it seems like there's another trade-off involved, which might be having a wing in case you need to start gliding, for example, if you have a total failure. I mean, with a multi-rotor, if you really literally lost all electricity, isn't your glide ratio at that point zero?
Yep, pretty much. Most of these cannot auto-rotate. There are, we're very involved in discussions with the FAA. I will say that it is certainly a benefit if you can glide as well as a mitigation for that loss of all power. I would, however, caveat that with ourselves and I assume all of our other competitors, we're really designing that complete loss of electrical power to be extremely improbable. So this is a really low probability event targeting, somewhere between 1 to the -7 and 1 to the -9 possibility of this happening per flight hour. And that's through having redundancy in the battery packs, redundancy in the motors, and how they're all connected together.
Besides aircraft efficiency, as you described there, Jeff, what other factors come into play that might affect the cost of these kinds of aircraft?
Yeah, so we like to think about the operating costs of these vehicles much like an airliner today. So kind of your major buckets are the depreciation of the airframe. So, an airline will pay some amount of money up front to buy the airplane and depreciate that over some period of time, 10, 15, 20 years. There's the cost of paying the pilots. There's the cost of maintenance. There's the cost of, well, in a traditional airplane, it's fuel. On a vehicle like ours, it's the electricity to recharge. And then the other important aspect is, I like to think of it as battery amortization. So the battery packs has a limited cycle life. So for argument's sake, let's say it's 1,000 cycles. That means every flight you're paying for 1/1,000th of that battery pack. So you kind of sum up all these costs divided by the number of flight hours, and that gets you to your, you know, your direct operating costs in dollars per hour.
Speaking of the pilots, the as we mentioned, the Vahana project was flown uncrewed, and most people will say that at least initially, with respect to urban air mobility, we're going to see piloted vehicles, maybe eventually autonomous. Does that seem like a future possibility to you?
Yeah. So here at Archer, we, you know, kind of looked at the landscape of from a regulatory standpoint, and it's pretty obvious that in the time frame that we want to bring a vehicle to market, getting an autonomous vehicle to market is going to be a real challenge. So we're making all our design decisions around that. Our first production vehicle being piloted. That said, to see the eventual scale that we, you know, we hope this industry reaches, autonomy will become almost a necessity, both by lowering operating costs and just the sheer number of pilots that are available becomes an issue if it really scales how people expect. So it's something that's going to take a lot of time working with the regulators, understanding the you know, what it really takes to replace a pilot on the vehicle. At the most basic level, right, pilot performs a whole bunch of functions, and those functions need to be replaced either by systems on board the vehicle, systems on the ground, or people on the ground. So that's how we think about it, and we're trying to, you know, understand those steps and work with the regulator to figure out the path to get there. But in terms of time frame, you know, that's probably end of this decade at the earliest is around what we see.
Speaking of people, how many seats do you expect to have? How many passengers could you potentially have in your first vehicle?
Yeah, so we're looking at a pilot plus 3 or 4 seats.
And that's probably something that could expand in the future, or do you see it kind of staying at that level?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So in some sense, it's limited, or it depends very much on the technology and how batteries evolve. So that's kind of the key. One of the key factors is, you know, how big and heavy do these airplanes get and how high can you get that payload mass fraction? And as batteries evolve, you kind of have a couple of options. One is you can make the battery lighter for the same combined battery and payload mass and add more payload. You can keep the same battery mass and get more range or maybe fly a little bit faster. Or you could redesign the whole airplane for the same mission, but have the whole airplane be lighter and cheaper. So yeah, it's something that will probably evolve over time, but with where we see technology today, you know, 4 to 5 seat airplane is about the limit of what we believe is technically feasible within the constraints we've set for ourselves, which are around operating in existing infrastructure, so heliports, for instance, and within the European and U.S. certification rules. So that sets a 7,000-pound maximum takeoff weight limit from the EASA special condition.
I want to get to the infrastructure issue, but before we leave the conversation about the pilots, what kinds of skill sets or certification are going to be required for pilots? Is this going to be a new category or something that falls under existing regulations?
It's a good question. I don't think we have the exact answer today. So those are things we're discussing with the FAA. You know, those are ongoing discussions. I think at a minimum, we would see a special type rating, but the hope is that, you know, a commercial fixed wing pilot would be capable of flying these aircraft. We're really focusing on simplified. I don't know if you guys are familiar with simplified vehicle operations from Gamma, thinking about making it very, very easy to operate these vehicles and fly them.
At the extreme, do you think that it could be as little as a Part 107 pilot, so someone who's gone through yet a UAV type training?
Probably not in the short term.
I'm so maybe happy to hear that.
maybe in the long term, but yeah, I would put that kind of closer to the autonomy time frame.
All right. Well, let's talk about the infrastructure a little bit. Obviously, we don't need runways with VTOLs, eVTOLs, but what do we need?
Yeah. So at a minimum, we really like to look at the there's an FAA AC, can't remember the exact number, on heliport design. So this lays out the requirements for the TLOF, takeoff and landing space, the FATO, final approach and takeoff, which is another box around that, and then a safety area. So roughly you need like a order of 100 foot by 100 foot area for those takeoff and landing pads. Then it gets into a question of how you architect your vertiport, where, you know, do you park the aircraft on that pad and charge it there and have people get in and out? Or do you have multiple parking spaces per pad? So yeah, beyond that, it's charging infrastructure to be able to, you know, recharge the airplane, possibly some, you know, on-site maintenance facilities, and then being able to process passengers and get them to the aircraft.
And Jeff, here's, I think, why you probably didn't remember the number. I've looked it up. All of our listeners probably have this on the tip of their tongue. Heliport design AC is AC150/5390-2C.
There you go.
For the interested listener. On the infrastructure, when you look at the existing infrastructure airports, obviously there are lots of differences between different airports, regional airports, GA airports, large commercial airports. But there are a lot of similarities. There are probably more similarities than differences. When we talk about air mobility in this sense, does there need to be a consensus or common standards created across, well, not just maybe the United States, but maybe the world?
Yeah, I think so. And there are folks working on those sorts of standards. I can't remember exactly the standards organization that's working on it.
Trust got to look it up. He'll find it. He's fast on the keyboard.
You know, ICAO, SAE, ASTM, one of them is probably working on this. So yeah, I think, you know, if there is standardization, that certainly helps the industry going forward. But there's, you know, we think there's at least a pathway to starting operations with existing airports and heliports. And we do really see existing airports being some nodes in that network.
That would make a lot of sense for a couple of reasons, but one of which, I mean, those are the transportation hubs, not the only ones, clearly, but they already exist as a transportation hub. So to leverage that.
Yeah, some of the really high-value routes in cities will be to the major airports. I mean, I think you can probably see this today with where majority of Uber rides go, or a large fraction of Uber rides go, at least, is to transport hubs.
So you're working on an aircraft now. What's your projection for first flight?
Yeah, so we're currently putting together a demonstrator aircraft that will be released here this quarter publicly, and that first flight should be before the end of the year. We're still on track for that, and then we're working in parallel on the certified product design, and our goal is to shooting for a type certificate by the end of 2024. So it's an aggressive schedule that we're working really hard towards.
And what kind of support are you getting from the FAA? Are they approaching this in a, you know, a supportive role, or how are they viewing this?
Yeah, they've been incredibly supportive. So we've been working with their office there to really lay the groundwork, and we're getting close to having certification basis set for these vehicles, and working very closely on the means of compliance as well. So the FAA has a team of around 50 people that are assigned to support our project. You know, not full time, but they're part of reviewing the certification basis and means of compliance for our vehicle.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. What about public acceptance? Do you see any issues there?
Yeah, certainly. So we think this is incredibly important. And, you know, really engaging with communities is going to be crucial. So there are two, like the one that everybody thinks about is the noise of these vehicles. So we're putting a lot of effort into a low acoustic footprint. you know, that's in a lot of major cities today. That's what limits helicopter operations is the noise impact. And then also just, you know, there's to really get acceptance to people, you need to get the cost down to where everybody thinks that they could take and use this service in the future. You don't want it to be something that's only for the elite that nobody can access.
Mm, for sure. And the noise part of that, though, clearly compared to a helicopter, you don't have a turbine engine that's going to generate a lot of noise. An electric motor is generally
electric motors are really quiet.
Yeah, really quiet. You've got the, you know, the rotor noise. I would imagine they're not as buzzy as a smaller quadcopter because you've got larger rotors. But is the technology advancing in terms of reducing the noise?
Yeah, for sure. So the electric motors really enable you to push the rotor design to a different place than you would for a traditional helicopter or even a general aviation airplane. So the rotors are the dominant noise source for these sorts of vehicles. And the really big levers that you have to control that noise are the tip speeds and the disc loading of the vehicle, or overall thrust, I guess. And so like a traditional helicopter has a rotor tip speed somewhere in the like Mach 0.6, 0.7 range, and even faster when you're in forward flight. Our hover design values are down, you know, in the less than around 0.4 range. So it's pretty dramatic decrease in overall noise levels in hover and transition. And when you get to cruise flight, if you're up at a 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet, the vehicle is almost silent on the ground. So you have these relatively low thrust, very high solidity, slowly turning propellers.
So you mentioned, I think, much earlier on that some designs are tilt wing, some are tilt rotor. What approach is Archer taking?
Yeah, so our configuration has six tilting rotors in front of the wing. And then after the wing, we have six fixed rotors that are only used for the hover and transition phase. And they're two bladed, and then they stop and align into like a low drag configuration aligned with the flow for cruise flight.
You must be doing a lot of modeling. Are you doing that all in wind tunnels, or is it being done in digital simulations?
Yeah, it's a combination. So you want to do a lot of both computational analysis and actual testing of components to validate those analysis models. So we've been building a lot of hardware and testing it. So we have a motor test stand where we can spin full scale hardware and measure the performance of the motors and propellers, at least in static conditions. And we'll be doing that soon in front of a wind tunnel as well. We fly subscale models that are really used for tuning our flight control laws. So they're dynamically scaled. The handling qualities, the actual flight control software will be the same that flies on the full-scale vehicle, just the dynamics are a little bit faster and the gains are tuned for the smaller vehicle. So it's, kind of a whole gamut. And then simulation of all of these things where we can look at off-nominal conditions, failure cases, different environments, et cetera, to really understand the performance of all the systems and the vehicle itself.
As far as the avionics are concerned, do you have a partner that's providing that, or is Archer developing that?
Yeah, I probably can't say too much about that. I would say for our demonstrator, we're using off-the-shelf hardware where we can, but with custom software. And we're still, for our production vehicle, still in the early stages of identifying partners and suppliers.
Have you identified the test pilot yet? Is that you?
No, we just hired our chief test pilot, though.
Yeah. So I imagine this person would want to be kind of actively involved in what happens between now and that
first flight. They're going to be very involved in the design as well, the layout of the cockpit, what's displayed on the flight management system, PFDs, et cetera. They will be intimately involved in the design of the aircraft.
How do you find a test pilot? I mean, you don't put an ad in the newspaper. It says, hey, who wants to be a test pilot? Right? how do you find someone like that?
Yeah, so we put a job description on our website that gets sent out, and then people also work their networks for folks they've worked with in the past. So we have a a really strong team that has deep ties throughout the aerospace industry. So we had a lot of really interesting folks we talked to.
Tell us a little bit about the employees, the group. What kinds of skill sets, what kinds of backgrounds do they have?
Yeah, so our engineering team today is around, I think, 70 people. We've been growing pretty quickly.
Wow.
Let's see, we have I would say probably half of the team has come from an eVTOL background. So folks who've, been in the industry for 5 to 10 years. A number of my team from Airbus Vahana came over. We've also hired some folks from WISC. So that really set the core team. And then we've been trying to bring in experts to really augment that from around the industry. Folks who've been through certification, understand major development programs. So we've got engineers from who've worked at Bell, Triumph, Cirrus. Lots.
Yeah, quite a collection.
Boeing, et cetera, like bringing in a wide gamut to really help us chart this path towards certification, which is our first goal.
Now, of course, United has already placed a large order with Archer. And isn't United also an investor in the company?
Correct. They're a participant in the PIPE associated with the SPAC.
So does that take does that take some of the pressure off to know that, there is a customer at the end of this tunnel?
Yeah, there's a customer and actually a really good partner. So we have a lot that we can learn with them, work with, understand, they can help us a lot with their pilots, maintenance, et cetera. Like we have really good resources to help us understand that part of the business and really design the airplane for the end user in mind. That you may not get if you're not working closely with an operator.
Yeah, for sure. That just seems like a really nice place to be, when you're at this stage in the development and all, to have, that kind of a relationship. That it's just got to help in so many different ways. The folks that work at Archer, I imagine that people are pretty pumped about what they're doing. Do you all feel like you're on the edge of some future greatness?
Yeah, it's really exciting. We're extremely fortunate to be in the situation that we're in. So it's we're really trying to make the best of it and build a great product that hopefully people will really love and use in the future. And at the same time, I think as you stated there in the intro, we're really trying to build a sustainable mobility company. So it's really important to us, this move towards electrification and how we really long-term reduce the environmental impact of aviation overall. So this is a great, great first step towards that.
Just one more comment from me anyway on battery technology. And I mean, we've seen progress being made in terms of the energy density, but there is kind of still a ways to go with that. Are we close enough now to produce aircraft with what we have, or is it completely, when you look at 2023, 2024, are we counting on increased efficiencies?
We're not counting on any dramatic advances. So we have the math on our website. So around the battery performance numbers, the aerodynamic performance, the weight of the vehicle, et cetera. So we're relying on, cells that are commercially available today, energy densities, not even as good as in some of the most recent cars. And the reason for that is that the power requirements for these vehicles are higher than they are for a car. And when you have to generate that power, you pay a small penalty in specific energy. So we're really focusing around what's available today, and you can really do interesting missions with that. Now, as batteries get better in the future, we'll be first in line too to get the latest lithium metal and silicon anode technologies that will unlock that next step in performance. They make a lot of sense for these small vehicles for these missions. I think it's going to be a while until you have an electric airplane that again will do your San Francisco to Los Angeles flight, or longer term, transoceanic. I'm not sure that'll ever happen with battery power.
Right, right. What kind of flight duration is Archer looking at?
Yeah, so it's something on the order of typical missions, 20 to 30 minutes with a max endurance probably on the order of 40 minutes to an hour. Again, it depends a lot on how much of the segment is VTOL, how much you're holding in reserve, et cetera.
Of course. Well, fascinating topic. And it's one that just keeps coming up in part because of the number of participants, as we mentioned earlier. And it just ranges completely from, you know, the airframers and legacy aerospace companies to startups and everything in between. So it's definitely exciting times. And so, Jeff, we really want to thank you for spending a little bit of time with us. It's a fascinating topic. And well, with Trescott being so close to your facility, where are you going to perform the first flight? Is that going to be in the California area?
It'll be in California. I'm not sure I can say exactly where our flight test site is yet, but sure there'll be more info on that coming soon.
All right. Well, if you can slip that to Max Trescott at some point, I'm sure he'd be glad to show up and, you know, support the effort. And David also, David's made it known that if anybody needs a test pilot for anything like this or a test passenger, he's more than happy to participate. You still feel that way, David?
Yeah. No, I'm perfectly willing to be luggage.
Okay. Well, it's encouraging, I think, that a few years off, 2024, sounds kind of like a long time in the future, but in terms of these kinds of projects, it's right around the corner. It's pretty quick. I'm sure, Jeff, you and the team at Archer Aviation is extremely busy these days.
Yeah, we're very busy. There's a lot to do, but it's really exciting. Exciting things to be working on, exciting times.
For sure. All right. Well, thanks again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Max. Max and David, it's a pleasure.
On to the news. From the point sky, threaten a Delta employee, say goodbye to your SkyMiles account and elite status. Well, Max, we know the FAA is cracking down on unruly passengers, and so apparently is Delta.
Well, we just talked a week or so ago about the very large fines that the FAA has imposed on some of these passengers, up to around $32,000. But of course, what matters to different people, you know, is different things. So for some people, having lots of sky miles and having elite status, which gets you to board the aircraft first and to be able to upgrade and so on, well, all those things could just be taken away if you happen to be one of these unruly passengers. And I would have to think that probably a lot of the unruly people are not people with elite status, but who knows? You know, I suspect that alcohol gets involved in a lot of these things, and anybody, regardless of which part of the airplane they sit in, you know, might imbibe a little bit too much, or you know, might have very strong feelings about the mask. But this is one more stick that the airlines can use. I think they'd probably have to let people, you know, they probably have to publicize this widely for it to be really effective, because I'm guessing that most unruly people wouldn't find out about this until after they've lost all their sky miles.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Now, and interestingly, Delta's change to their sky miles program terms and conditions applies not just to behavior in the air. Delta says that this new provision applies across the travel journey. So that includes the interaction that you might have with Delta's reservations or customer care phone center or its gate agents, as well as the flight attendants, ground handlers, and arrival teams. So, again, it's not just bad behavior in the air. And what is bad behavior? Well, Delta gives some examples of it. They talk about personal threats, profanity, obscene language, insults or slurs directed to a Delta employee or ambassador. And it also covers any intentional destruction to Delta property, which seems appropriate to me.
And of course, the big three competitors have not called out similar kinds of rules. So I would imagine they would. This seems like such an obvious thing to follow on. I mean, just what's the downside of this? I guess the only downside would be that people might leave Delta and go into the other airlines, and they can get more abusive customers there and grow their business that way. but who wants that kind of business?
But you know, I have a feeling that deep down, if somebody gets this happens on Delta, Delta and the other airlines have a way of knowing about that individual.
I don't know. Do they trade information like that? I don't know.
I would be surprised if there isn't some sort of communication system.
Well, another issue is just because it's in the T's and C's doesn't mean that Delta is, or any airline or any company is necessarily going to exercise their full rights under those terms and conditions. It's not unusual for a company to include language that gives them the company more power than they intend to typically exercise, because it gives them the flexibility to take that action in extreme cases. So that's another thing to watch is, are these powers exercised by Delta and the others if they follow suit?
And we've talked in the past about the number of people who've gone on the banned no-fly list because of mask violations. I just saw a story within the last day or so. I forget which airline it was. And they said that the ban will last only for the duration of the requirement to wear a mask on aircraft, which I thought was kind of intriguing. I think what they're saying is, yeah, we're going to ban you for bad behavior, but you're allowed to come back after a while.
Well, it's a timeout. That's all. I mean, bottom line is, if your behavior is bad enough to warrant Delta to take this kind of action, you probably shouldn't be flying. You know, take the bus. It's sort of
or walk. Just get out of our hair.
Yeah. Well, it's not often that I'll take the sides of an airline, but in this case, expectations of reasonable behavior are not unreasonable.
Yeah.
And the other thing about it, folks, if you're listening out there and you are this type of person, this isn't a challenge to Delta to see if I will lose my points, what I need to do to lose my points. It's not a contest. So, I mean, and since the beginning of the year, these kind of unruly incidents have gone up. I mean, not necessarily dramatically, but they have gone up since we've started to resume back to, quote, normality, unquote, on airlines that we didn't see before the pandemic.
To me, the big overriding issue is that there has to be, in my opinion, there has to be a hard, fast, enforced rule, which is that you comply with the crew. Doesn't matter if you think you're right and you think they're wrong. It doesn't matter. It has to be, in my opinion, it has to be that, you know, whatever they say, you have to do that. And if you don't do that, then game over for you. I think it has to be that way, because other, you know.
That's funny. I enjoy kidding around with flight attendants, but there's one time when I'm absolutely deadly serious, and that's if I'm seated in the exit row, and they ask their questions about do you understand the language, and are you willing to comply? Man, it's just very simple. No joking. Yes, 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 because I want that seat. Yeah. and I have heard of people being tossed out for not giving them prompt and correct answers.
Yeah. Well, because people's lives depend on it. You know, you're getting rewarded for agreeing to do something that, you know, most people don't think they're capable of doing or don't want to, you know. So, yeah, that little bit of extra leg room, I mean, is kind of important. It's a contract. We're going to give you a little extra room, and you promise to, if necessary, execute the way they tell you to. So,
oh, the heck with the extra legroom. I just want to be first out that window when I open it up.
I don't want to go out that window.
I don't think you are. Are you?
I don't know. I'm just kidding. I love the legroom.
To anybody out there who's an FA, if you're at the window seat and your job is to open the window, open the emergency door. Are you the first one out, or are you obliged to let other people out first? I don't know that rule. That would be kind of interesting to find out.
Moving on from simpleflying.com, we have fresh FAA concerns set to delay grounded 737 MAX's return to service. Yikes, here we go again. Last month, Boeing asked 16 customers to temporarily ground 737 MAX airplanes. And this was due to an electrical grounding problem on some specific tail numbers. Now, this was a manufacturing issue, not related to MCAS or any of that other stuff. But it could have significant implications. The issue is that there was a manufacturing process change. And according to the Seattle Times, they reported that a backup electrical control unit that was that is secured to a rack on the flight deck was originally fastened with rivets, but the manufacturing change was to use fasteners instead. And the question is, but is there still the same electrical grounding path that existed when they used the rivets? And so that's sort of the core of the issue. And originally, people seemed to suggest that the fix would be fairly quick and that these specific airplanes would get back into the air pretty quickly. But now the FAA wants to see more analysis that shows that this problem, this electrical problem, does not affect other subsystems.
This is kind of weird. This has got to be one of the first times we've had an electrical ground an aircraft.
Well, I was just about to say that. We are actually talking about grounding an airplane due to grounding issues.
Right, exactly. Poor electrical grounding.
Okay. Just wanted to make that clear. Way to go, Boeing, for coming up with something really bizarre.
Well, and just to let people know how a lot of the wiring is done on aircraft, you need two wires basically to power anything. So in general, you know, we run two wires to a light bulb in our house, two wires to the doorbell, you name it, it's two wires. But one of those paths can be a common ground. And so for some things in an aircraft, they'll just run a single wire out to a particular device, and then they will attach the other end of that device, be it a light or something like that, to the airframe itself. And then the power flows back through the airframe, you know, back to the power source. And so if you have a problem with the ground, you could be interrupting electric, you know, power to many, many, many different devices, which are, you know, powered through that particular path. Now, I would imagine that, you know, Boeing has a number of critical devices that have two wires run out to them and they don't rely on the ground, but there are going to be many things that do rely on the ground. So yeah, this is an important issue for them to get a handle on.
It sure is. And it's not the only issue, as it turns out. You remember our little primer, was that last episode, on the LEAP engines? Remember the LEAP 1B? Remember what the B stands for?
Boeing.
Boeing, that's the engine on the...
See, I do pay attention even though between sleeps.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So that's the engine on the 737 MAX exclusively. Well, there's an AD out from the FAA to check a pressure transducer. The issue here is possible corrosion. And this is on engines that were out on long-term storage. The FAA is requiring that checks be completed before each flight during the first 15 hours of power being applied to engines following prolonged storage. And the FAA cites that moisture ingress from long-term on-wing storage coupled with certain manufacturing processes of the affected pressure transducers. They say these conditions can cause corrosion and subsequent electrical shorting of the pins in the pressure transducer. This can result in transmittal of erroneous pressure sensor signals to the electronic engine control. That's not good. In fact, it could result, they say, in loss of engine thrust. That's especially not good.
Well, I think they said reduction in thrust as opposed to complete loss of thrust. And, you know, these pressure transducers usually go to the FADEC, which is the, what, full authority digital engine control. And it's going to use inputs such as pressure, temperature, fuel flow, all those kinds of things to kind of calculate how much fuel flows out to the engine. So it may not be total loss of engine power, but, you know, any loss is going to be of some concern.
You know, it is kind of amazing that the Boeing 737 MAX has gone out of its way to prove that airplanes are complicated. You know, it's amazing how often things just occur like alarm clocks.
Yeah, it's on the hour.
It is amazing, though. And I think Max Trescott has said this, that he's perfectly willing to fly a 737 MAX because it's probably the safest airplane on the planet right now, because anytime even the remotest thing even looks like it possibly may break, the FAA and Boeing and everybody else is going to put the kibosh on flying them. It is kind of amazing that this is a storage issue that comes from storage in the desert, though moisture is developing inside the engine. I'm like, okay, then why are we storing airplanes in the desert? Wasn't that the reason why we deployed? I mean, it just never ceases to amaze me that airplanes are complicated.
Yeah.
We just can't park them next to a cactus, because eventually the water from the cactus, you know, gets into the airplane.
The agave gets. And, you know, not to minimize it, but airworthiness directives, these kinds of engineering problems, I'll call them, come up maybe more frequently than most people realize. I think now we're in this mode of heightened awareness where any issue whatsoever gets a lot of press. But these things actually, I don't want to say they happen quite often, but they, in a sense, they kind of do.
Often.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other part about it is I think this is another result of social media and a 24-hour news cycle. Airworthy directives have been around forever. But, you know, in the 70s, I don't think anyone would be saying that the Boeing 707 had an airworthy directive over its turbofan engines and they grounded 30 of them. You know, it just wouldn't make the news. Well, yeah. In a world where news is 24/7, even the littlest thing will affect. But you get an airworthiness directive now on, say, another type of airplane, it probably wouldn't make the news. It's just the words MAX drives everybody nuts, you know. I've been working with two of them for years, and it just sort of
we drive you nuts.
It just sort of, you know, you mention the word MAX, and people go, "Which one?" It gets very confusing after a while. But that being said, I think it is what it is. And like you said, Max, airworthiness directives happen all the time in the military, and happen all the time in general aviation. And I mean, though, when was the last time an SR-22 had an airworthiness directive on it, Max?
You know, I don't know that there has been one, but certainly there have been some service bulletins on different Cirrus models, for example. I know on the angle of attack indicator, I don't recall if that was a service bulletin or possibly an AD, but they very quickly replaced those in the entire fleet over a period of about 2 weeks. And that was over a year ago that happened. I think we talked about that on the news.
Yeah. Wasn't there something about the headset jack or something like that? Or am I thinking of something else?
Yeah. You're thinking of the fire that occurred in an aircraft on the ground in Santa Monica. Yeah. And I think that was traced back to an audio component.
Yes. Yes. That's right. But yeah, they do happen. Let's see. When did this happen? In March. There was an issue with the Leap 1A, right? The same engine that we were talking about that powers the A320 family for Airbus. There was a manufacturing quality escape. This affected the high-pressure turbine cases that could cause uncontained engine failures. And the reason is that some X-rays
on some of the bleed parts showed that they were, or they had non-conforming indications.
You should see his eyes light up, folks, as he's talking about this. The joy that comes across Meg's face as he's talking about bleeds and blades and all of the other accoutrement that goes with engines.
No. But, you know, I mean, this could have been a big issue as well, except that if you look into it, you find that this occurred in 8 engines in the U.S. fleet, right? So these kinds of things happen, you know, with, like I said before, with great frequency. But something else that doesn't seem to be flying so much with great frequency is the Airbus A380. We've talked about that. It's from the Point Sky. The A380 was a great idea at the time. I think it was motivated by high passenger volumes and airport capacity that was somewhat lacking. So it made a lot of sense to stuff one plane at a gate instead of 3 smaller airplanes at gates. But I think the problem is that those conditions don't really exist to the same degree now. So in the Point Sky, Malaysia Airlines is latest to say it will abandon the Airbus A380. I think they have around 6 A380s, and Malaysia Airlines is kind of joining some of the others that have grounded all or some of their A380s.
Yeah, there's no question that the pandemic has hastened the kind of end-of-life issues with the A380. And when I say A380, yeah, some of these airlines are retiring them, and some of them may still show up elsewhere as new aircraft for a new startup that's willing to buy used aircraft. But I think for sure we've seen the A380 is probably past its peak, past its prime. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's easy to forget that it also had a lot of startup issues. We were talking about all the problems with the with the 737 MAX. But the A380 in its early days also had so many problems that I think their launch customer was Singapore Airlines. And a friend of mine who's a pilot for Singapore Airlines told me once that they had a nickname for the A380 because so many times it would take off and have to come back because of a problem. They called it the A180. Yeah, because it was great. Making a 180 and returning back.
Yeah. Well, the aircraft seems to still be working for Emirates. Of course, Emirates always had the largest A380 fleet. I think something like about half of all A380s sold went to Emirates, and they're still flying them. BA has some still. Singapore, a few others plan to keep flying the A380. But yeah, you know, I think this is the second item from the Point Sky that we've had on here. I noticed that the Point Sky, which is a great source of information, they have an app for iOS coming. I'm not sure what features it's going to have, what the value of it is going to be that it can provide, but they have a, quote, wait list, which I think really means it's like you get notified when it's available. So if you're interested in that, that's at thepointsky.com/app, APP. And you can sign up to be notified when their new app for iOS is coming.
And do we know what that app does? Or no. Are apps just so desirable that we'd want to get any new app, no matter what it is?
Any new app. No. I've actually been going through my phone, looking at all my apps and deleting the ones that, you know, I haven't been using because it just clogs things up. But, yeah, I bet the Point Sky app could be a pretty good app. All right. Next, Flying Magazine. Now, there's a new U.S. airline that started operations, and it's got a name that I notice keeps getting pronounced differently, depending on who you listen to. AVELO. So I've heard it pronounced in the press Avilo, Avilo, and Avello. I think it's Avello. Max, yeah, what do you take?
That was my guess. Yeah, in fact, I didn't even think about alternate pronunciations. That's the one I instantly thought of when I looked at that. Yeah, the pandemic certainly has proved to be a fruitful time for new airlines to launch. And this is yet another one, which seems to have the model of serving unserved airports. And I think that's an easy place for new airlines to kind of get customers without having to compete with other airlines that are just going to basically cut fares to match them and try and drive them out of business. So it's a pretty clever strategy. Avelo is going to start with a hub at the Hollywood Burbank Airport, which is at the, kind of at the northern end of the Los Angeles basin. And then their first news release, they say that their first flights are going to be going to the Charles Schultz Airport in Santa Rosa, California, which is probably an hour and a half drive north of San Francisco. They don't have a whole lot of flights into that airport. There have been times in the past when they've had no airline service into that airport. And it kind of remains to be seen just how much volume of business there would be between those two city pairs. Now, they say the route's going to be served by a 189-seat Boeing 737-800. And my instant reaction is, whoa, that's too big an aircraft for that particular route. But it may be the case that Santa Rosa is underserved, and people have always had to drive to San Francisco, and they may now be able to pick off customers who might normally be driving down to San Francisco and will be thrilled to have a service available to them in Santa Rosa. So this will be kind of fun to watch and see how successful they are.
They say, did you say what the fares are that they're advertising?
Well, you can look at this and you know they couldn't make money if they sold every seat for this. Sporting everyday low fare starting at $19.
Yikes.
I mean, come on. That would pay for gas for about 1 mile between, you know, those cities.
That's right. $10 to check a bag. That's not bad. And no change fees, which is great.
Well, they only fly to one airport right now. So where are they going to change to?
Well, they're adding many others. And in fact, I saw an item in Business Insider. Did you know this, Max? They're coming to Connecticut. Hmm. Yeah. They're going to come to a new base in New Haven, Connecticut. That's Tweed New Haven Regional Airport. They haven't announced the routes yet, but, you know, underserved airports.
Yeah. And some of the cities that they mentioned here are on the West Coast. And, you know, they're, I would say, small cities, you know, cities of 100,000 and less that just don't have much airline service right now. So Redding, California, Arcata, Eureka, which is way up in Northern California, Medford, Rogue Valley, Oregon, which is just across the border in Southern Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, which is just a little bit further north of that. This one I like, the Bozeman Yellowstone Airport. I mean, it would be nice to be able to have some good service into Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah. You know, I looked up the executive team for this airline, and it's kind of an impressive group. The founder, who's also the chairman and CEO, is Andrew Levy. He was previously a co-founder and president of Allegiant Air, and he was the chief financial officer at United. He's also a board member of Copa, the Latin American airline. And the chief operating officer, Greg Badden, he's had more than 40 years of commercial airline experience. He's got 20,000 hours as a commercial airline pilot, and he led flight operations at Allegiant Air, Delta, and Northwest. While the vice president of flight operations, Andrew Lauder, he has almost 30 years of commercial airline experience, 10,000 hours as a commercial pilot. He's the former COO of Extra Airways, senior VP of operations of West Air, and president of Ameriflight. And there's a few others, the VP of Tech Ops, 30 years commercial experience. He led Delta's engineering and quality assurance team, started at Eastern Airlines as a structures engineer, the vice president of customer experience. Victoria Stennis has more than 40 years of commercial airline experience. She was JetBlue's first VP of in-flight experience, had other roles at Delta and others. So they're, you know, the leadership team is drawn on a lot of experience. That doesn't, of course, guarantee the success of the airline, but at least it's a good place to start.
And did one of you say just before we started the show that we've got a member of our team here who's planning to fly them at some point in the future and report on them?
Was that you?
I thought someone said that Brian Coleman was going to try out this
area. Oh, yeah. Brian would be a natural for this.
Yeah, because he lives pretty darn close to Burbank.
Yeah. Could give us a trip report. All right. This is an interesting item, I think, because it's a drone. It's drone news, but it's significant drone news. Dave and I talked about this last week. It comes from Drone DJ. And the ASRS, the Aviation Safety Reporting System, of course, well-known in manned aviation, it was created by and is run by NASA, it's being extended to drone operators.
Max and I were both really excited about this. We've talked about ARAS for years, and I know Mr. Trescott has high praise for the idea of self-reporting and... it's going to be opened with specific forms. Our friend Ken actually had something to do with it, and we will probably be getting him on UAV Digest. But they're opening it up to drone operators for self-reporting, much like the general aviation aspect. If you report, there's a good chance that you're not going to have any penalties. But it's another way of the FAA bringing drone operations or drone piloting or however you want to call it, in line with the general aviation and the commercial aviation industries.
Yeah, ASRS was created. I can't remember exactly what the event was that spurred it, but essentially NASA was designated as the agency to run it because they wanted to be independent of FAA so that there wouldn't be any retribution for pilots who might report things. And they have a very rich database. It's one that I go to from time to time to try and find things that are trending. For example, one of the things which I found recently was in the past year when I did a search on iPad, there were at least 6 reports of pilots who said that they accidentally flew into temporary flight restrictions or TFRs because of some issue with either their iPad or the electronic flight bag that they were running on their iPad, which either hadn't been updated or had the TFR layer turned off or things like that. So it's a great place to spot trends. And the office is literally 4 miles from me. It's in Sunnyvale, California, and they have a number of retired airline pilots that work there that go through all these reports, sort them, catalog them, and they also have a monthly newsletter called Callback, which is available to anybody who wants to sign up for that. And that's just search for ASRS or NASA ASRS, and you'll find a link to the newsletter.
Yeah, I think this is big. I think the real task at this point is to inform and educate the unmanned aviation community as to, first of all, what this thing is, but the importance of it, what it does, and what it doesn't result in, which is retribution for self-reporting problems. So, because I think people in the unmanned space that come from manned aviation are probably going to be familiar with ASRS, and it's a logical thing to extend it to drones. But people who grew up in the drone world, not in the manned aviation world, I think they're going to need some convincing that this is something that they need to participate in. So I hope that we see that. I think that's going to be important for its success. All right. One other, another thing that's important is always when you arrive at your destination on a commercial flight and you're standing there at the luggage carousel, seemingly endlessly waiting and waiting and waiting for your luggage to come out. If it doesn't show up, if it doesn't come with you, that can be a huge, huge problem. And Max, I guess there's been a sort of an interesting instance of this.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned endless because Wilkes-Barre Scranton is in the area of northeastern Pennsylvania that is known as the Endless Mountains, and that apparently is where one customer's luggage is located right now, somewhere in the Endless Mountains. Yeah, so apparently a SkyWest flight under contract to operating as American Eagle for American Airlines was flying from Scranton to Chicago, and they returned back to the airport in Scranton due to a possible mechanical issue. And apparently it was more than just a mechanical issue. Apparently there was a baggage door that was open, and they were minus at least one bag for this flight as well. And it says the flight landed safely, taxi to the gate under its own power. They're investigating the situation, and they're very sorry for the inconvenience. Of course, the inconvenience would be searching through the endless mountains to find that one bag that departed the aircraft in flight.
There's a lot of rural land out there, as I recall. I mean, this could be a bag that doesn't show up for years or if ever.
Yeah, this seems reminiscent of D.B. Cooper, you know, parachuting in the middle of the woods in Oregon somewhere. It's a little more densely populated northeastern Pennsylvania, but you're absolutely right. It may take some hunter in deer season wandering through the woods this fall to find this bag.
Yeah. Either that or I guess we would have heard it by now if somebody walked outside to find a luggage falling from the sky and hitting the ground.
Well, it's good. I mean, at least the airlines are being creative. They now have one new way to lose passengers' luggage.
And you know what? Speaking of airlines, it wasn't United this time. It was SkyWest. I'm very impressed.
So why are you picking on United?
Because they're untried. I mean, United?
Yeah. All right. What's up with the geeks? We have Launchpad, our reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He's always, you know, the guy's always thinking about something. He's always, I don't want to say scheming, but, you know, he's always coming up with something. And he's come up with something new again.
Hey, Max. I was cleaning out my flight bag from Sun and Fun, and I still have some Airplane Geek swag. So let's give it away. I've got some genuine Airplane Geek refrigerator magnets, so let's do a giveaway. As an open cockpit airmail pilot, so to honor that, send us a postcard. That's right, a snail mail postcard that has an aviation theme on it. Send it to Airplane Geeks, 2965 Mystic Mountain Lane, Belton, Texas, zip code 76513. And we'll send you a genuine Airplane Geeks refrigerator magnet while the supply lasts.
All right.
This is a really sneaky way for him to build up his aviation postcard collection. That's all I can say.
Because I don't know where you find aviation postcard. You may have to, get a blank postcard and create your own. Put your own artwork on it, maybe.
I'm thinking Launchpad is probably selling them on eBay, and people will buy cards from him and mail them back to him, and he can sell them again.
Oh, that's too much. All right. So, so I'm not going to put his address in the show notes because I think that might be a mistake. So rewind and write down that mailing address. That may not be his. I wonder where that goes, actually. And I don't know how many magnets he's got, but interesting idea. So thanks, Launchpad. Thanks for that. All right. I'll just mention eatattheairport.com. You've heard me talk about that. This is our little global map of airports that have eating establishments on site or really close. And we've been getting some activity, some new submissions, and even most importantly, some updates to previous submissions, which we appreciate. And there's now 481 airports worldwide at eatattheairport.com. So if you encounter an airport diner or eating establishment, head on over to eatattheairport.com, search for the airport. If it's not in there, then you can submit it. And if you run across some changes, we've had some eating establishments that have closed, some temporarily, some permanently. So we like those updates in there. So just a little report on that. 481 airports. That's pretty impressive. All right. Max Trescott, what's up with you?
Well, I want to let folks know about episode 187 of Aviation News Talk. This week, we have an interview with Dr. Greg Venn. Now, he works at the Mayo Clinic, and I wanted to talk for some time about hearing loss and how it affects pilots and other aviation workers. And he and I had connected on another topic, and he happened to say that he had been thinking about doing the same thing on his podcast, which is a medical podcast for pilots. And I'll mention that here. It's called Mayo Clinic Clear Approach. So if you're interested in a podcast on medical issues, check that out. But we basically talked about how hearing loss affects people in everyday life, some of the many different situations, even just ordinary things such as, you know, driving long distance with your car window open can generate noise which is above the threshold that can damage hearing. And of course, we talked about things that you can do when you're in an airport, even outside the cockpit. You know, there are a lot of noise sources that are outside the cockpit that can be damaging both to pilots as they're walking across the ramp or ramp workers who are working on the ramp. So I would encourage anybody who cares about their hearing, and I would say that should be all of us, to take a listen to 187 of Aviation News Talk. And I will say that I have some hearing loss that I discovered very early in my career. I was tested when I was working for HP, and they found that I had some high-frequency loss. And I think a lot of that came from my playing around in ham radio as a teenager. I was trying to listen and talk with people in all 50 states on the 75-meter band, which is quite a challenge, as normally that's a fairly short-distance band. And I still remember trying to pick out signals from Alaska amidst the huge static crashes. And afterwards, I would go to bed, and my head would just be ringing from that. And I'm sure that that's probably what damaged my hearing. So all kinds of ways to lose hearing. And unfortunate, it's permanent.
You mean my 80s hair band rock concerts that I went to? Probably has screwed up my hearing for a long time. Not to mention hanging out on flight lines with jet aircraft.
Right. Well, and the interesting thing is those are kind of obvious ways to damage hearing. What's probably less obvious and probably more insidious is wandering around with your phone plugged into music in your ears and cranking that up, as sometimes we'll see teenagers doing. They may not be aware that they're damaging their hearing permanently just by listening to their music too loudly as they walk down the street.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I have hearing loss too, but that occurred in 1971 or 72, I'm not sure which. Black Sabbath at the Fillmore East. That was the loudest. I don't know what the decibel level of that thing was, but my ears rang for 3 days after that concert. I'm sure that's why I can't hear anything above about 6,000 or 7,000 hertz, I think.
And last week, the excuse was drinking. This week, the lack of editing prowess is because he can't hear now, which is kind of funny considering he's the primary editor for the show. Actually, he's the only editor for the show.
Yeah. Well, so, Max, what was the name of that podcast again?
It's known as Mayo Clinic Clear Approach. And Clear Approach is the name of their telemedicine program. And so this is a podcast that supplements that. And Dr. Venn is an AME, so he's a medical examiner who does FAA physicals.
So I just checked. I actually don't have that in my gigantic directory of aviation podcasts at 30,000feet.com. So I'll have to...
But he'll add it right away.
Yeah, I will add it. Yeah, if you need more podcasts to listen to, 30,000feet.com... I've got 100 of them in here. All right. Let's see. Where are we now? That might be about it. David, anything going on with you? Or everything's great at the American Helicopter Museum?
Everything's great at the museum. We've got lots of people coming in, and hopefully within next week or so, I'll actually have my online store up and running so you can buy helicopter swag.
Cool.
So looking forward to that. So when that comes up, I'll give everybody the link to the museum. Otherwise, it's AmericanHelicopter.museum.
Very good. All right. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We especially want to thank our guest, Jeff Bauer from Archer Aviation. And you can find them at Archer.com, as a matter of fact. And you can find us at AirplaneGeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/653. That's the episode number. And, of course, you know the email where you can send us kind words, nasty grams, whatever you like. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And Max Trescott, where do we find you? Oh, all the usual places.
Of course, the usual places. You can find me on social media, Facebook, Twitter. But the main place to go would be out to aviationnewstalk.com. Just click on contact at the top and you can shoot me an email.
And David Vanderhoof, of course, any place you can spell Vanderhoof.
Any place you can spell Vanderhoof. And of course, the UAVdigest.com on Fridays with Max. And last but not least, of course, on our Slack listener team. And you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com to join the conversation there.
Terrific. You can find me, as I said, at 30,000feet.com, all words. And that'll send you off to the different podcasts and places where I hang out. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.